哇 ，TV Party Tonight， 哦
，We got nothing better to do than watch TV and have a couple of brews。
Don't wanna talk about anything else。
We don't wanna know。
We're dedicated
to our favorite shows。
All my tickets。
Everybody loves Hypno Toad。
Gary Dawg。
Larson and Blurnville。
Futurama。
Good evening. You are listening to a Rattlesnake Broadcasting premiere podcast, TV Party Tonight. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattlesnake. And tonight, our favorite show is Dark Side of the Ring, brought to you season three, part one, brought to you by the good people at Vice TV. Executive produced by Chris Grosso, Evan Hesney, and Jason Eisner. Joining me tonight to talk Dark Side of the Ring, finally, this is the podcast that almost didn't happen. Ladies and gentlemen, you've heard him. Now you can see him in all his glory. Ladies and gentlemen, Pat Mullen, how do you do, sir?
It almost didn't happen. Funny things happen when you get blackout drunk on a whim, you know.
I don't often get drunk dialed, but when I do, it's pretty hilarious.
Oh yeah, I was in no state of mind to be doing anything. It was. I got molested at the bar by some chick, and I was with my friends, and we stumbled into somewhere where there was a live band playing, and I made an Irish exit where people were questioning where'd I go. And my best friend told the other two friends we were with, he was like, "Ah, don't worry, he's probably in a bathtub somewhere missing a kidney. It's fine." In reality, I just went to buy Listerine at the 7-Eleven, but yeah.
All right, so we talked the first
years.
And indeed, we talked the first two seasons of Dark Side of the Ring, and we enjoyed it. You know, some episodes were better than others, but, you know, for the most part, I think they've done a pretty good job with presenting these different stories. Where the very first season of Dark Side of the Ring was, you know, they dealt with like Jimmy Snuka, if I remember correctly. And
no, Jimmy was season two.
Season two, yeah, it all runs together. It does feel like, you know, they went after, in the first two seasons, they really did go after like the big stories in wrestling, the big dark stories. And now they've kind of hit, you know, the top of the list. They're kind of searching for, well, what else is out there? And so the kind of season three, I think it was a lot of people's wish lists to some degree or another. There were some interesting stories here, and then in others just kind of felt like we heard that there might be a story here. Let's talk and see what they might possibly be. And so the list here is Brian Pillman, parts one and two. It was a two-part episode. Nick Gage, the deathmatch wrestler, or Outlaw Mud Show.
Don't call him a wrestler.
The outlaw Mud Show performer. Collision in Korea, The Ultimate Warrior, Grizzly Smith and His Family, Jake Roberts, Sam Houston, Rockin' Robin, and then The Dynamite Kid, and they will continue with the next half of the season sometime in September. So let me ask you first, Pat, their choice selection of topics, what did you think? You think they picked a bunch of good ones, or, you know, they were like, I don't know about some of these?
For the first part of season three that we've sat through, I think each of them, with the exception of one glaring exception about some outlaw Mud Show drug addict bank robber who calls himself a wrestler, I think it's a fair selection. What they do with that selection, we'll get to in this, but I think there are stories that needed to be told, and maybe not in the way they've already been told. We've seen documentaries on Brian Pillman, on Jake, but not on his full upbringing, along with his siblings, for that matter, who were also in the wrestling business, and his father, Grizzly Smith. Dynamite had one made a few years back that had very limited distribution, and I think his story is one of the more interesting ones you'll come across. And Collision in Korea, I remember that event happening, and as a kid, and we ordered the pay-per-view, and I didn't understand a lot of the cultural ramifications at the time. And then as you learn more about Korea as you age, you're like, how did this even work?
Yeah. Let's talk about Brian Pillman. We're going to go through these episode by episode and spend a little bit on each one, and then we'll give our final thoughts of part one in its entirety at the end. So I got to ask you first, are you a big fan of Brian Pillman? Did you follow him because I didn't know about Brian Pillman until he came in over in 1996. And I remember thinking at the time, like, why did they bring in this guy over with the broken ankle? Like, like in my mind, it was kind of like the Lex Luger thing. It was like, he showed up 5 minutes later, he was injured. And I'm like, why are we doing this?
I was a huge Flying Brian fan from WCW when he debuted. And he had, as you see pictured, the amazing series of matches with Jushin Liger. That just immediately captured me as a kid. And I was like, whoa, this is not like anything I've seen before. This is amazing. And, you know, to see Brian kind of fight his way up the card, only get knocked back down. There was just something about him as a performer at that time that was really cool because he was very unique in what he could do. Mm-hmm. And had an intensity about him for a small guy that a lot of guys didn't have. And I think it's just maybe part of that Calgary thing for these guys as they come up. But I was a big Brian fan, and it's funny, the part of his career everybody talks about, the loose cannon, which kind of started the tail end of his WCW career, obviously was really the meat of his WWF career. But I at that point, I had kind of lost it because Brian, once the ankle injury happened, Brian as a performer was, particularly in the ring, was kind of just done.
He was way ahead of his time in a lot of ways. Like if we could adjust his career so that he is wrestling the last 20 years, especially with the size of the guys now, like he would fit in once he wasn't able to fly like he used to in WCW and he had to be a more grounded wrestler. He still would have done okay with the guys like Daniel Bryan or Christopher Daniels or, you know, the guys more suited to his height and weight. I mean, the wrestling industry in many ways has changed. Sure, you still have large beasts out there. But the Ring of Honor thing really did affect modern wrestling culture, I think. So I think, you know, I just think that he came too early, especially, you know, with the injury, how it affected his ability to wrestle.
Even if he comes along, say, you know, maybe 5-6 years later than he did when they actually had a full cruiserweight division that they invested in WCW and really pushed. Yeah. You know, he would have been, you know, right there with everybody and would have had a leg up on a lot of the luchadors that they brought in and a lot of the Japanese guys because Brian was such a personality that it would have been easy for people to invest in him. That's one of the things that set Chris Jericho apart from all those other guys when he was competing with the cruiserweights. Jericho had such a personality about him and was so entertaining that even if he wasn't the best in-ring competitor, you know, compared to other guys at the division at that time, because you had Rey Mysterio, Hoovy, a lot of great talent. Jericho's personality and the little things he could do outside of what happened in the ring made him so much fun and so entertaining that they basically made him the centerpiece of that division for 2 years. And a lot of that you could see in Brian.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So my memories of Brian Pillman, and then we can get into the episode itself. My memories of Brian Pillman, which they talked about in the documentary. I don't know if you saw the WWE one that they did on him, the loose cannon, years ago. You probably did. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the most famous thing he ever does in the WWE, and it was like the canary in the coal mine for what would happen because. Pillman's got a gun. That's got to be what, 96, right? Because
that was 1996.
Yeah.
And the same night I was signing up for my first amateur wrestling team and begging to get home because the signups were at night at the rec center. Mm-hmm. And like, I had just seen the part where they were talking about Steve Austin might invade Brian Pillman's home. And I was like, we gotta get back.
It's so funny. Cause like, I would say 93 to 95, I didn't really watch a lot of wrestling, probably none of it. Like I think I was like ancillarily aware that Diesel was champion. I remember the feud with the Undertaker and Yokozuna. Like there were certain things that I watched with my friends. Like I watched the Royal Rumble with Yoko or whatever it was. I guess it was Survivor Series with the Undertaker and then Royal Rumble with Chuck Norris or however, whichever direction it went in.
Opposite, but you're there.
Okay. In any case, you know, and I remember the Underfaker at SummerSlam and all that, but like, I wasn't watching Raw in the early years and I wasn't really keeping up with the product as much. It was like, oh, the Undertaker's wrestling Yokozuna, Chuck Norris is going to be there. Come to my house and watch. Okay, fine. So I started getting back into wrestling probably around the Royal Rumble of 96. And You know, and that's when I started, watching Raw again. And that's when I became aware of Brian Pillman. And so, you know, Steve Austin, that year's King of the Ring, you know, infamously, he wins it because Triple H had just done the curtain call. And he's going to go on to feud with Bret Hart, and they'll have their match Survivor Series that year, which I was at. That was at Madison Square Garden. That's the same night as Shawn and Sid. But in between, like, the summer was him and Brian. And that's when, if I remember correctly, or like going into the fall, that's when they did the Pillman's Got a Gun thing. And I remember, like, the week before, at some point in this, my memory's a little fuzzy, but like he did the bit with the chair, and yes. Then, you know, and then it was like
Pillmanizing.
Yeah. Pillmanizing. No. And so Steve Austin's like, I'm going to just kill Brian Pillman. That's my, you know, it had to have been, he Pillmanized him, because then the next week he was home, and that's why. And then, and so I was like, I'm going to come to your house.
He had the walking boot on, you know, he was laid up in the house, and
I'm going to come to your house and just kill you. Like, okay, well, I'm going to turn into Raw to see that. I didn't give a shit about anything else happening on Raw at the time. I was like, I'll watch Steve Austin kill a guy in his house. And so they filmed a home invasion. It was great.
Yeah, I remember, like, they had the guys who were standing in that were supposed to be Brian's neighbors protecting him. And you see Steve Austin beating them up in the driveway. And then he breaks the kitchen door, like the glass of the kitchen door. And they try to get in. And you hear Pillman's wife screaming. And
it's so funny. God.
So fun.
So yeah, so then he breaks into the house, and you know, and Pillman's got the gun on him. He's like, oh, I'll kill you. And then it goes to Fuzz, and like, I think the announcers are like, okay.
Yeah.
So are we gonna have a match? Is there gonna be any wrestling tonight? So funny. So Brian Pillman's story in Dark Side of the Ring actually very much resembled, I think, the documentary. It wasn't a whole that. Focusing on Melanie Pillman was the interesting stuff to me. The stuff about Brian wasn't as interesting, only because I kind of knew the story already. So, like, my wife, who watched it with me, this has been our Thursday date night. We watched the season together. We watched Dark Side of Football. We just watched the China, vice versa. She didn't know Brian Pillman's story. She wasn't really aware of him at all. And she found the stuff about him being a diminutive athlete, but kind of rising above that, to be really fascinating. We both found, like, his football coach to be the most hilarious part of that episode.
But Kim Wood.
But the stuff about his children and Melanie and the first wife, that to me was the big anchor of the story.
Yeah, I would agree, especially when you hear his sisters talking about, they were like, Melanie is not a good idea. Don't do this. And then they don't really touch on it as much as you would maybe have thought they would have, but they don't go into the fact that Melanie had been dating the Ultimate Warrior prior to this, and there was a beef between Brian and the Warrior because of it. Like, Pillman threatened to kill the Warrior at some point, because I guess Warrior was still calling Melanie at a certain point when he divorced from his wife and he was hanging out with Melanie, and Melanie ended up with Brian, and Warrior's still calling her, and there's a whole mess of a situation.
They conveniently skipped over that in the Warrior doc.
Yeah, the first time I ever heard that, I think it was Raven was on Jericho's podcast, and he brought that up, and I was like, well, if it's Raven, to just throw a good story out there that nobody's really ever heard or touched on.
Of course.
But I think the more interesting parts belong to kind of Brian's sisters and Brian Jr., for that matter.
Yeah, for sure. You talking about the son that wrestles in AEW, right?
Yes.
Yeah. His story, actually, like, him, you know, he didn't even want to be a wrestler at first, but then he became a wrestler, and he wanted that approval from his dad. And I don't want to get off on a tangent, but like, AEW not immediately pushing him in light of that documentary. Who's running that company? Monkeys?
Well, I mean, Kenny Omega is your world champion, so what do I know?
Hey, Kenny Omega. Anyway. Just final thoughts about this episode so we can move this along. I think the thing that I was most looking forward to was Melanie's reflection on the post-Brian death interview, which I'm going to go ahead and use this opportunity. This is my podcast, and some, you know, if I can bloviate, I will.
Why not?
Sure. One of the most disgusting things I've ever seen Vince McMahon do was in that interview with Melanie Pillman. I mean, like, the company not known for its class, but that was an extra special level. I mean, and I'm just talking about the stuff they've done on camera, the stuff they've done behind the scenes allegedly. I'm not going to get into. But the stuff I saw with my own eyes, this might have been the worst thing I've ever seen. It's debatable that continuing over the edge after Owen fell to his death might be the worst. But again, that's open for conversation. Interviewing Melanie Pillman the way they did in light of Brian's death was, in my opinion, the number one worst thing they've done in terms of
not terribly classy or caring. However,
that was the word I was going to use.
The more time you spend in this documentary talking to Melanie and listening to her and hearing what Brian Jr. has to say, very not surprising that she would participate.
No, clearly she was somebody with substance abuse problems, and she was somebody who had some mental health issues, a lot of mental health issues. But that's, you know, and I'm not saying she is utterly, and no one had a gun to her head. She made a poor decision in a situation where another person was able to take advantage of her. So, I mean, there's two sides to this. There's, she let it happen, but they didn't have to do it. You know what I mean?
No, but then, you know, you go to the things like the Brian Pillman tribute shows that Les Thatcher ran, and WWE and WCW were allowing talent to go ahead and work with each other, and all the money was supposed to go to Brian's kids. And you find out that Melanie and the guy she ended up with bought a new truck for him. And, you know, Brian and his siblings didn't see any of that stuff. And, you know, David Arquette wound up giving more money to his family than, you know, those shows wound up generating because of how Melanie and the new husband, I guess, or whatever he was, wound up just kind of frivolously throwing it around.
Mm-hmm. So your final thoughts on the episode? I thought they did a great job with it. I really have no qualms with it. Sometimes these guys don't necessarily hit the ball when they get up the bat with some of these episodes.
But which we'll talk about.
Yeah, but I think this one, it, with the two parts, not as good as Eddie and Benoit from season two, but still, I would say this is at least a triple.
I think for seeing how much ground had already been covered in the previous documentary that was released, and if you're familiar with that, this maybe doesn't resonate as well. But if you had never heard any of Brian's story, I think it was handled reasonably well. They included a lot of detail. I think they talked to people they should have talked to from both sides of his family, be right. It Melanie on one side or his sister Linda and Brian Jr. and his other daughter.
I mean, it's not like it was a documentary filled with comedians and talking heads.
Yeah, who would ever do that? But yeah, we didn't get Dan Soder in this. We got a pretty decent story told about one of the more eccentric and interesting personalities that you'll come across.
All right, let's talk about your favorite wrestler. He's currently on screen right now.
That's not a wrestler, so I don't know who you're referring to other than maybe Drew Gulak.
Let's talk about Nick Gage.
Yeah, let's not and say we did.
All right, I got to ask, since this was sort of their death match episode. But they focused solely, you know, they focused on him as the centerpiece, but this was sort of their way of speaking to the death match culture. Are you not I can see you rolling your eyes. Are you not a death match guy?
Here's the thing. When you talk about a death match, okay, there are workable death matches that you can do. There's things like a Texas death match. There's things like Mick Foley and Terry Funk's version of a death match. Then there's idiots who take pizza cutters and put them in people's mouths against their will. Idiots who work in some secluded area in Delaware so that they can be a not around the law, who want to shut the show down by a bunch of damn morons playing wrestler when really all they're doing is assaulting each other with household wares and pretending they know what they're doing and trying to see who's extreme by who can mutilate themselves the worst and do some dumb shit like that. And he's an idiot. Why? He's an idiot bank robber drug addict who just the only reason he got an episode, let's be clear, the only reason he got an episode on this is because they were tight for material, and it's very easy to get some idiot deathmatch outlaw mud show moron to talk about himself for 2 hours than it is to lock down people from a major company who are related to somebody from a major company to talk about some scandal that maybe they want to keep buried.
So you didn't like the episode?
I didn't even watch the episode.
Okay.
The only line I heard from that episode that was funny was I heard Jim Cornette talking about how John Moxley was on the episode. I can't stand him either, but he was on the episode and talked about how no matter what, where they were performing, Nick Gage would always have a bandana over his face, except for when he robbed the bank and walked in full view of the camera with his full face in view. That sums up all you need to know about this idiot, doesn't it?
He's not a Mensa student, no.
He's an idiot.
So you didn't watch it. I'm not going to spend a tremendous amount of time on it. My opinion on the episode was this. I like watching death matches. Not every one of them is a winner, just like anything else in wrestling. But there's fun. I've talked rather openly and rather fondly of the one with Schlack and Abdullah something or other. Ayatollah something. Yeah. In Japan.
Great one. 5 stars.
And, and it was the one with the light bulbs all around the ring, and they were, like, biting them and stuff like that. And it was only because, like, I hadn't seen – it was in the early on of my GCW watching phase. And we had – the match itself was whatever, but my son and I had a fun time watching it. I haven't watched a lot of
Nobles. You subjected your kid to that.
We did. I haven't watched a lot of the No Holds Barred series. I've had too much other stuff to do now that the world has opened up again. But I will say this. The Nick Gage story, there was just stuff I didn't know. I didn't know he nearly died or did die and
wouldn't have been
in a helicopter. So this was one of those episodes where it was kind of educational in that I didn't know a lot of the stuff they were talking about with Nick Gage. I'm like, oh, that's interesting that happened. That's interesting that that happened. His story, though, is kind of, okay. You wrestle in matches where you take light bulbs to the head, then you got a painkiller addiction and you nearly died.
And robbed a bank.
Both of those things. And in between, you robbed a bank for drug money. And you're still doing these things. You're still, like, I don't know if he's still popping pills, but he's still doing the death matches. It wasn't like he looked back upon a life, poorly lived and was like, well, I try to be better now. He's out there trying to kill Matt Cardona. Moxley showed up at one of his shows too, and like they're gonna have a thing.
He's the idiot who almost killed David Arquette.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about that. Were you pay much more attention to wrestling than I do, especially they're like a really
that's debatable now. Stuff.
Did you know about the Arquette thing when it happened?
Not when it happened. I was watching the David Arquette documentary.
Okay,
and they bring it up in that, and David Arquette basically says, he was out with the guys the night before. He took them all out for a steak dinner or whatever. They're going to do the show. Mm-hmm. And he asked, like, listen, because I'm going up for this part, just please don't cut me.
Yeah.
And, you can say whatever you want to say, but, he was nice enough, polite enough to do that. He's working with the guy. The guy's getting a bigger payday because he's working with David Arquette. Let's call it what it is.
Right.
And the idiot pulls out the pizza cutter, big surprise, and starts slicing David Arquette's head up and puts the damn thing in his mouth again. And just, at that point it turns into an assault and the idiot should be back in jail where he belongs, dying in a corner from, some disease he got from sharing needles or pills.
They actually brought all of that up in the Nick Gage episode. The David Arquette stuff I was kind of ancillarily aware of too, but I never got the details on it. I think once you last thing I'm gonna say and we'll move on. Once you get to the point of going, I'm really going to cut this guy to the point where the guy is now having to like fight for his life and like defend himself. And like, he's like throwing up a triangle and stuff. And it's cut anyway. Like, this isn't pro wrestling. I'm willing to accept a lot of nonsense in pro wrestling, but once you get to the point of no means no, and it just as much means no in the wrestling ring as it does anywhere else in the world. If you follow my meaning, if a guy says, don't cut me, that's the end of the story. You can't be like, well, you have insulted me, sir, and I shall cut you anyway. For people listening on podcasts, I just did the crusty face. Collision in Korea. Did you watch that extemporaneously when it came out? Well, was it ever? I guess it was available as a VHS.
No, it was available as a pay-per-view offering in the summer of 1995. I forget when the actual event took place. I think it was March or April of 95, but then they edited the two nights into a pay-per-view show. Mm. And I believe it was in July or August of 95. Cause I remember watching it. It was July or August 95 that they aired it on pay-per-view one time. And then I don't know that they ever released a VHS commercially of it. And I know it's still not been released on WWE streaming platforms and anything like that.
What'd you think of the event when you saw it?
It was cool. You know, they showed a lot of the pageantry and everything that went on internationally, which always kind of makes it seem like a bigger deal. And I got to see a lot of people who I hadn't seen in the U.S. for a little while, like Too Cold Scorpio and the Steiner Brothers and Hawk, who were all kind of working either independence only or in Japan because they just weren't signed by a major U.S. company. So that was kind of a treat. And then it was interesting to see Inoki and Flair together for the first time, both very well past their primes, but still kind of just from that historical standpoint, like, oh, cool. It's these two guys together for the first and only time.
So I knew nothing about this. And this is, you and I talked about the Brawl for All in our last season review and how, like, it was one of those where we hoped there'd be like some really juicy insight into this and we'd learn something. And we were both grossly disappointed at how little there was to that story. It kind of, it was what it was, and whatever had been talked about in interviews or shoot videos, or whatever, that's kind of it. It was a very shallow story. And this one feels like they were brainstorming and someone brought up, hey, didn't WCW do a show in North Korea where freedom doesn't exist or light? And they're like, how the fuck does that happen? Like, we got to make something of this. There's got to be a story here. And so they did it. They committed to it. And they were like, oh, not a lot here.
Yeah, truthfully, they missed the boat on this because Eric Bischoff's podcast, 83 Weeks, he did an episode dedicated to the event.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Eric was on the episode and he contributed, I feel like his podcast gave us much more detail about everything that went on than the stuff you really want to hear about. I've read Scott Norton's book that came out.
Scott Norton has a book?
Yes.
Googling that now.
Very, very fun read. Talks a lot about his arm wrestling days and stuff, but he was one of the principal people involved in this. And probably of anybody contributing to the episode that wasn't talking about a personal beef with Road Warrior Hawk, he probably was my favorite of the
Scott
people.
Scott Norton was easily the highlight of this episode.
Yeah, I would agree. And his book talks in a little bit more detail about, you know, the phone call incident to his wife where the Korean police grab him and they have guns pointed at him. And he gets the way it's described in his book gives a little more detail to the hostility they were facing and everything, where their passports were taken. Mm-hmm. And again, I've listened to Too Cold Scorpio's shoot interview that came out. I think it was like 2002. And he talks quite a bit about beef with Hawk during this trip. The only new info we got on that was Norton talking about how Hawk was on medication for Hep C. And what that does is basically like kind of just really weakens you.
Right.
So. And I can kind of buy that because I watched Hawk has a match, a singles match on the pay-per-view. Mm-hmm. I think it's been a while. I think it was with Tadao Yasuda, who became the IWGP champion like 6 or 7 years after that and was one of the lame duck champions. But Hawk wrestles him on this. And normally Hawk's wrestling somebody, especially in that kind of situation, he's going to beat him up and eat him up.
Mm-hmm.
Works very, very safe, like powder puff clothesline type stuff. Doesn't really do any press slams or anything. So I can kind of believe Hawk's probably not feeling his best.
Right.
And the one story that I wish they would have included that they didn't, that Bischoff did on the podcast, they had like this grand buffet prepared for all the guys when they came to Korea at first and whatever. Mm-hmm. And they served them all this, like, I guess it was supposed to be chicken. Nobody really knows if it was or wasn't. But they serve them this food and whatever, and they come to Scott's diner and they feed Scotty. And Scotty immediately starts spitting this food out. What the hell is this bullshit that you're serving me? This is disgusting. Get it away from me.
Right.
Well, a lot of the poor people in Korea were going through a famine at the time.
Yeah.
And I mean a literal famine where it was not uncommon that the people who lived on the outskirts of the main urban area were cannibalizing their dead.
Right.
And Scotty's just spitting out all this fresh food all over the ground and – yeah, they didn't look too fondly at Scotty after that.
So, again, I watched all of these with Melissa, and we both kind of looked at each other when this was over. And, like, they're – especially with the music they were choosing, like, this is generally not a series where I pay that close attention to the music. I'm more interested in the stories and the interviews. But this one was so boring that we kept noticing how dramatic the music was. It was dun-dun-dun. You know, it's like Too Cold Scorpio's like, and I almost killed Hawk. Dun, dun, dun.
I was sharpening my metal chopsticks that I so clearly pilfered during this dinner. And
yeah, like they are making so much hay out of so little. It was
the most interesting part of the show was hearing Scorpio describe how to make a shiv.
Yeah, I have to say on the subject of pageantry, visually speaking, it was a sight to behold. It's something that if it's ever available to watch online, I might actually make myself sit through. I like the guys that are on. I like Scott Norton. You know, I like Too Cold Scorpio, whether he was dressing as a pimp or not. You know, I think there's a lot there, you know, to watch. But as far as like the story behind it, I mean, it was like, well, someone wanted to do a goodwill show in a country that doesn't get much Western culture. And they did. And a couple of wrestlers almost got into a fight.
Or killed. Okay. And I will agree with Norton that there's probably a pretty good chance that if Ali's not there, one or two of them might not be making it back home.
Sure. The other interesting thing was at least Scott Norton's account, and like the biggest bit of tension for me watching the thing was Scott Norton telling the story about how they dragged him into this room, you know, and was like, don't say shit about this country, asshole. Like, and I'm sorry, I come from the land of assholes. We're allowed to talk this way. I'm a stupid American. And they're like, all right, go behave and go be a wrestler. Next episode, The Ultimate Warrior. You know, you and I have done like 9 hours worth of talking on The Ultimate Warrior.
Boy, have we.
I'm not going through all that again. We have the In Defense of Ultimate Warrior show that's up Unsolved in the archives. Mysteries. Yeah, the Unsolved Mysteries of his title run. You can, you know, and then rebooking it so that it actually makes sense and money. They're both in the archives. They're there. The only one that hasn't gone up yet, I'll put it up at some point again, is Remembering the Ultimate Warrior After He Passed Away. So like I said, we've talked about this man a lot. So let's just talk about this episode. This episode, I think this episode is actually best watched if you've watched the A&E biography. Here's the thing about that. The A&E biography was one person's account of the Ultimate. I was wondering what you were getting up for. Nice. Okay, for people listening and not watching the audio, Pat pulled an Ultimate Warrior pull string toy. Made some sort of sound. This is best watched. I wonder if you agree with this. If you really do need to watch the A&E biography, and you need to watch this one, because to me, they are companion pieces. Yeah. One of them is Dana Warrior's account and sort of the Ultimate and sort of the WWE's account of the man's life from their perspective without doing the self-destruction thing all over again. It was kind of we're painting a nice picture, but it's our version of the nice picture. And then there's Dark Side of the Ring's version of it, which is his first wife's story. And they had to call it the Ultimate Warrior because this is about wrestlers, but this was really her documentary. There wasn't a whole lot said by anyone else. I mean, headline, Jim Cornette hates the Ultimate Warrior.
Headline, Jim Ross hates the Ultimate Warrior.
Film at 11. You know, okay. A, we've heard both. Jim Ross is...
go ahead. B, fuck Jim Ross.
Okay. Jim Ross has spoken publicly, you know, his account from, like, the self-destruction video has not changed.
What the hell is this true shit? Yeah.
I would love to know more about that meeting because that can't possibly be all he talked about.
No.
You know, we've heard Jim Cornette on his podcast. I listen to both. If you listen to my wrestling reviews, I refer to him constantly. We've heard Jim Cornette. We've heard Jim Ross both talk about him publicly and in countless number of shoot videos. So there was nothing new there. And, you know, their takeaway from the Ultimate Warrior on this show was he didn't like the business. Goldberg didn't like the business and was just there for a paycheck. Other people have, you know, didn't necessarily care about the business, but were there to do a job and do it well. But he gets crucified for it.
Yeah, because he was the biggest star of them and made the money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, was the guy who got the torch passed to him by Hulk Hogan. That's the thing. That's what rubs people the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even his ex-wife in that documentary, Sherry, she even is like, no, he knew what a big deal it was, and he appreciated it. And there were certain people who came to his defense in that regard on mm-hmm. both documentaries to a certain level. But the people you're talking to and who you got involved. I wish Gary Hart was still alive. Gary Hart, longtime wrestling manager, mostly based in Texas and Detroit, but also the booker of World Class Championship Wrestling. He pretty much got Warrior's start in World Class after Warrior left Mid-South.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes about it in his book. I got actually was talking to the Dark Side of the Ring guys a while back during season one and sent them a digital copy of Gary Hart's book because it's out of print. And they talked to them about it, and they were like, wow, this is great. And he has a chapter on the Warrior where he talks about how Warrior made it clear to him. He goes, Gary, I don't want to be the best technician. I don't want to do this. I'm not interested in this. I just want to learn what's going to get me over so I can be a star and make money.
That's a reasonable thing to say.
But he was upfront about it, mm-hmm. which a lot of guys maybe necessarily aren't. I think that's what got a guy like Lex Luger a lot of heat that he got over his career. Mm-hmm. Warrior basically made it clear, I'm not interested in going out there and being Bret Hart or Kurt Hennig. I want to just go in there, draw a crowd, draw an audience, make my money, do what I have to do in there to make people cheer, and then on to the next one. Let's go.
And you know, I respect the Warrior's opinion on the matter, as opposed to Bret Hart, who it's still real to him.
I can respect both your versions of that. You know, one guy who takes it so seriously and cherishes it and holds it dear, that's great.
Mad, I tell you.
Among other things. If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Or you may not like what you do, but you find a way to make it as successful for yourself as possible.
But that's the thing is, I don't think the Warrior didn't. There's hate it, I'm doing it, you know, and I love it. And I think he was just, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
I think he's doing it the way
doing it the way he mainly wanted to do it.
Right.
Not how he was expected to do it.
Right. I've only spent 9 hours defending the man and plus, but at least 9 hours publicly.
But again, and I'll bring back Gary Hart again, because mm-hmm. we talked about Jim Cornette and Jim Ross. These two guys will blow Sting for as long as you let them.
Mm.
But Gary Hart will, and they both love Gary Hart and talk glowingly about him. Gary Hart had no respect for Sting, who he felt when he met him was unappreciative, didn't care, was willing to take all everything he could and do whatever he wanted, didn't appreciate the people who were making sacrifices to help get him over. And to a certain extent, Warrior may have been guilty of that too, based on the Rick Rude story.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, Sting, who has this glowing reputation from Jim Ross and Jim Cornette and Ric Flair, had largely the same attitude as the Warrior in a lot of respects.
Right.
But maybe gets a pass from them because he was a slightly better performer. And I'm sorry, if you watch Sting, yeah, Sting was over.
Hang on. I think he gets a pass from them because he was a WCW guy.
I think that's also part of it. But again, Sting wasn't exactly Luthez in the ring.
No, he was not. I will just say this about the episode itself. Like I said, Warrior's ex-wife comes across extremely likable, very sympathetic. I liked a lot of what she had to say. We talked at length about the timeline in the A&E biography was completely screwed up. But I didn't watch
the A&E biography, so.
Okay. Basically, if I remember correctly, because I listened to our Unsolved Mysteries one too, where we talked about this, and the one we did with Gavin, if I remember correctly, and your memory's better at this sort of thing than I am, so if I'm wrong, correct me. But it was, they do WrestleMania 7, I think it is.
I was going to laugh if it was the WrestleMania on your shirt you couldn't reference.
They do WrestleMania 7, and his contention coming out of that is, don't you think, since my match was just as important as Hogan and Sarge, that I should get the same money as Hogan? And Vince says, yes. And then never gives him the money or something like that. And he shows up for SummerSlam. And then Vince fires him, and Vince's contention is essentially that the letter in which he says, don't you think I'm as important as Hogan, and I'm just going to stay home until we can work this out, is tantamount to, you know, voiding his contract. And so he's like, I can't wait to fire the guy. And it's like, then you should have said something then. You should have released him from his contract at that point.
Before he agreed to take a lesser payout than what he would have gotten had he waited longer.
Right.
In order to pay for the house he was, you know, in the process of buying that you knew about. And again, you know, he's calling you on some promises you made to him as far as like the Warrior hotline, the royalties from that, getting as much promotion as the 1-900 Hulk number or whatever, and all these things, merchandising, et cetera, houses. And, you know, because you're not following through on your end, he doesn't feel he should have to still be obligated to follow through the same way on his end, which is reasonable, you know,
right,
for the most part, in these types of relationships. And again, history is going to paint one guy who has control of the narrative as the good guy and one guy who doesn't have control of the narrative as the bad guy. And that's largely what the story was.
My anger with that episode is, once again, it's explained a little bit better in Darkseid, where at least, you know, you get
where we figure out that queering won't make the world work.
It's that's said on both documentaries. So the whole thing about money, you get some insight as to why he was going on about money as much as he was. Like, he had a lot of expenses. He had just bought a new house and all this other stuff. And like you just said, he was kind of counting on that money to pay for all of it. And when it didn't happen, this was a problem. All right. Now, it isn't just about he's a legend in his own mind. And it's like, can't we just be honest, you know, about people? That was my giant frustration. That's not the episode's fault. The episode itself was fine. I actually really liked it. I liked hearing the Warrior's ex-wife's sort of position on everything and her insight. That was the best part of the episode. Everything else is either I've seen it before or the people talking about it in this particular instance are douchebags. Anything else about the Warrior before we move on?
Yeah, fuck Jim Ross.
Yeah, fuck him right in his ear. Speaking of which. Let's go ahead and speaking of fucking people in their ear, let's talk about one of my sponsors.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Grizzly Smith, but let's go on.
No. Oh, God. That's even a worse transition. No, let's talk about Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Helps if I write these things down ahead of time. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M Network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M Network to download Grammarly for free. All righties. Now we can talk about Grizzly Smith, Jake Roberts, and Rockin' Robin, and Sam Houston. God, I remember Sam Houston from when I was a kid because he showed up a couple of times on like Superstars or whatever. And I'm like, Sam Houston? Why would you call yourself that? Isn't that like a dude from history? I was a little kid at the time. I vaguely remember Rockin' Robin in the early days of the WWF. And who doesn't know who Jake the Snake Roberts is? I have seen the Jake the Snake WWE documentary. I've seen the DDP thing that he did.
Beyond the Mat.
I have watched so much Jake the Snake Roberts. This was a very good episode in how it was structured, put together, the people they got to talk to. No, craft-wise, there are no qualms about how they handled the subject material. It might be, in terms of craft, just as good, if not better, than Brian Pillman and Dynamite Kid. In terms of subject matter, what a horrifying man Grizzly Smith is. It is amazing. Like I said, we just watched the China documentary, and that is speaking of long roads to ruin, that is just there's nothing redeemable about it in any way, shape, or form. It is a set. It's one of those where after you're done, you're just going to want to walk into the woods to live deliberately. I am just done with humanity. I can't.
That's funny because that's how I felt after watching her wrestle.
Well, that's a subject of a different color. We had a very similar reaction to the Grizzly Smith episode when it was again, this is our Thursday date night, and our Thursday date night was watching this rapist, this child molester, ruin people's lives. And by the end of the hour, my wife and I were like,
let's go tell the kids we love them.
Let's go hug our children, and then you and I don't need to talk for a while. Let's just be at opposite ends of the house. What did you think of this episode?
I think so far it's probably the best episode of the season that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
They took some horrific subject matter. And again, it depends on your general awareness of Jake and his family, how much you knew going into this.
Mm-hmm.
This was one of the episodes where they still put new details into this that I don't think anybody was aware of.
You're talking about when he showed up to Rock and Robin's house with the little with the child and said, "Do you have a tacker you can give her?"
Yeah, that's one of them for sure. Mm-hmm. Other thing, Jake had kind of alleged that his stepmother, I guess you'd call her, whoever Grizzly was living with at the time, had kind of sexually abused him and his brother, but never outright said it. In this, mm-hmm. he outright said it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then his father's reaction to when Jake came to him to tell him about it was, I'm going to use the word horrific a lot for this episode. you know, anytime I think I had a bad childhood, I just look at Jake and be like, maybe it wasn't so bad. and just, again, you know, them getting all three of the Smith siblings who were involved in wrestling and the unknown Smith, which also was a very good touch to get their other brother in who was never involved in the wrestling business to talk about things. But it also kind of paints you the culture of Southern wrestling to a certain extent, where Grizz was a fixture in the Mid-South territory and in WCW later on. And the fact that guys are joking whenever they would see, like, you know, young girls, like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old at a show walking by, whatever, they go, "Oh, where's Grizzly?"
You know, you say that like, oh, it's the wrestling culture. But I would tell you, up until about maybe 20 years ago, that might have just been the culture.
I don't want to damn all my friends south of the Mason-Dixon line in that respect, but
I don't even just mean Southern culture. I mean, like, it's I think living in 2021, and I don't want to get off on a cultural tangent here, especially not with you, because I know what you'll say. But I do think that it's only in recent years that so much of what was commonplace and common vernacular and just, you know, sort of just part of the culture that we're either tolerated or buried in some kind of way, it is now starting to get called out. I mean, and in some cases it's still happening, but you know, in if there aren't enough people talking about it, it doesn't get called out. Or so things get called out and they get called out on social media, but it's not really affecting the greater world. I think like something, you know, like child abuse, sometimes it comes to light. But I think more often than not, especially up until very, very recent history, it was one of those things like, well, that's just what those people do, and it's none of our business. There's no inherent value in getting involved on a child's behalf.
And there's, you know, as disturbing as a lot of those things were, maybe the most disturbing thing that they talk about in that documentary is that, you know, Grizz would be going on a road trip and would drive to some, you know, 14-year-old's house, go to pick them up to take them on the road for a few days. And the parents are there waving, "Nah, see you in a couple of days. Everything's great." Like you're letting this 7 foot, 300-pound man who's in his 30s take your 13 or 14-year-old child out on the road. To yeah. Be like,
but abused. Why? Like what did the parent, when I say why, like what did the parents think was going to happen? What did they, when, you know, like when the kids slept over Michael Jackson's house, the parents were like, "Well, he's having a sleepover with a pop star, and there'll be cookies and milk," and like they may have been utterly naive as to what was going to happen, or you know, drank enough or got enough money to say, "Well, it's worth sacrificing our child for this." Some people are terrible like that, but in the case of sending the 14-year-old off with Grizzly Smith, like, what did you think was going to happen?
There's no any which way you slice it, there is no justification for any rationalization that you tried to make in your head to okay that as a parent, as anybody. No, just no. Right. And then I think aside from that, when they go into the problems that each of the kids faced after the fact, you know, I remember I think it was like 2005, I'd heard about Sam Houston having to go to jail, and he'd gotten like his 20th DUI.
Knew nothing about that. Nothing.
Yeah, it was on like one of the like onewrestling.com or one of the other news sites or whatever, and it was like, how is this guy like still? And then, you know, you hear about him getting divorced from Baby Doll, who they did talk to in the documentary. I would have liked to hear more of her, honestly, than what we did get. Okay. You know, marrying into that family, but knowing Grizzly ahead of that from working in Texas and everything, and her parents being involved in the industry. But I think, again, and Jake's problems are very well documented through multiple films, not the least of which Beyond the Mat. And then you go into Sam and his constant problems with alcohol. And I know he got jailed for non-payment on child support that they didn't really talk about. And then Robin, who's kind of the least spotlighted of the three Smith siblings in wrestling, didn't know that she had a substance abuse problem at any point, which she kind of brings to light. And then, but again, knowing that she was molested by her father, knowing that she was aware of him molesting just young girl after young girl, trying to do it in her home, unannounced out of nowhere, is a scary, scary thing.
Yeah.
And you know, there's been hit pieces in these things. This is not so much a hit piece as it is trying to bring awareness to a very serious problem and a very bad man.
Yeah. I know this isn't a part of it, but you're talking made me think of it. I've a couple of times in this episode referenced the China documentary I just watched. One really funny line about that. They brought up the whole Hall of Fame thing. And there's this bit in the documentary about where we're going to try to get you into the Hall of Fame. And they cut to Steve Austin talking to Triple H about like why she can't be in the Hall of Fame, because you know he alludes to her having done porn, and like, well, we don't want people who did porn in the Hall of Fame because what if children look it up? But then they cut to Vince Russo, and this is why I'm bringing this up. It was really a funny line. He was like, "Can we count the amount of murderers that are currently in the WWE Hall of Fame among other felons?" I laughed hard at that. And you know, and that's the thing. And if just kind of round this back to Grizzly Smith, he's not, I don't think he's in any Hall of Fames or anything like that, but I mean, he was regarded as a, you know, a territory star of wrestling.
A lot of people loved Grizzly Smith and would talk about him in glowing terms. Ted DiBiase, who is, you know, a Christian minister now, talked about Grizzly Smith and how helpful he was to him in his early career, and how much and Grizz was great. You know, a lot of the people who talked about him. The only guy I ever heard outright say I didn't like the guy or he was weird or struck me odd was Hulk Hogan.
Can't wait for the dark side of the ring on Hulk Hogan. And then I let this fat radio guy bang my wife. Don't you understand?
No, it doesn't work for me, brother.
I keep seeing, when I was pulling pictures for this episode, I kept seeing the Dark Side of the Ring logo with Hulk Hogan's face on it. So I don't know if they're ever really going to do that, but that would be I could do three episodes on Hulk Hogan. It'd be fantastic. Let me tell you about the wife swapping years and how Randy, never mind. Last one, the Dynamite Kid. I have been talking a lot this episode. I've had a lot to say about these. I'm going to turn this one over to you, Pat. First, tell me about your history with the Dynamite Kid, how much you knew about him, how much were you looking forward to this episode based on it being about him?
As a fan of his work, this was probably the episode I was looking forward to maybe second most. The other one's going to be in the other half of the season.
Is it XPW?
No.
Because that's what I'm looking forward to.
No, I'm looking forward to Bruiser Bedlam / Johnny Canine, because that story is a wild one that needs to be told, and I don't think most people are aware of it.
I think Jim Cornette fed them that one. By the way, I happened to put on Twitter that I was looking forward to the XPW episode. You know who contacted me as soon as I wrote that tweet?
Rob Black.
He did. He's like, is this who I think it is? And I'm like, it is, Rob Black. It is.
For those who don't know, Mark actually worked for XPW.
I did. I worked on both sides.
Yes, the wrestling and the porn.
That's right. I am in a porn, but not doing anything sexy.
No, you have the Vince Neil cameo in John Wayne Bobbitt's porno, where he just grabs a bottle of Jack from behind the bar and goes back down.
Yeah, I'm in a blowjob compilation, and they cut to me getting hit in the head with a guitar. There, that story's out in public now, I guess. I've probably talked about it before on podcast. But
so anyway, the Dynamite Kid.
Yes, the Dynamite Kid. If we could stop talking about blowjobs for just one
minute. I kind of was aware and watching wrestling when the Dynamite Kid had basically kind of washed out of the WWF and wasn't really seen all that much. He did his stint in Calgary after the fact, but really that was kind of the end of Dynamite. But again, through the magic of Coliseum Video, I used to rent a lot of tapes, and just the Bulldogs as a team always stood out to me for the things they could do. They were just magic. And, you know, Davey was always around pretty much, but, you know, he changed, you know, getting bigger and bigger and more muscular and you know, kind of less athletic for a period of time. But Dynamite was this little compact guy who just shredded with muscle and could do like all these things at such a high speed and was so acrobatic. And then years later, there was a store. I used to live in Jersey, and there was the Route 18 flea market. And in that flea market, they had a wrestling store that did a lot of business with RF Video, among other people. They had a ton of Japanese tapes, and they had like best of compilations of guys. And they had Dynamite Kid, and I was like, oh, let me get the Dynamite Kid tape. And I saw his matches with Tiger Mask and all the, and Fujinami and all these junior heavyweights, and I was blown away. I was like, this guy was incredible. And then on the opposite side, I got to read his book, Pure Dynamite, where he basically is a very bitter, very broken individual who buries people. And you got to hear stories in shoot interviews and stuff of him having little man complex and just being a mean, nasty, surly guy. And then you go on later to read books like Bret Hart's book, where he talks about the extremes that Tom put his family through and just craziness that pervaded his life. And they don't even touch on a lot of those things in this episode, which I was disappointed by. They did an interview with Dynamite a few years ago, and he kind of talked about some of them himself.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, do you think there was just not enough time, or do you think they wasted it on other stuff?
I think they might have been afraid to touch on it a little bit, because I'll share the story here. Basically, J.R. Foley, who was a manager in the Stampede territory, he and his wife had fallen on hard times financially. And then his niece, who he was responsible for, got into a pretty bad car accident, so they were expecting a big insurance settlement. They went to a doctor who said, nah, she's not really that beat up. Everything's going to be fine. And that kind of crushed Foley mentally. And then the rumor, the story that has gone around, is that Foley went to Dynamite and said, I don't know what we can do. And they talked about breaking her legs for the insurance money.
Are you fucking serious?
Yes. You never heard that?
No, I never heard that story.
And I know Diana put it in her book, but you have to take that with a grain of salt, because Diana's book is very much fiction at certain points. And she was led to believe the writer had her best interest, whatever. It's a story that's been repeated, and allegedly Dynamite and JR, with the niece's consent, broke her legs and fucked her up for the rest of her life so they could get an insurance settlement.
Mm-hmm.
They asked Dynamite about that right before he had passed in this interview he did, and he goes, true. And I don't know that it's true or not, because to me, just the more you learn about this guy's personality, he's the type of guy that would cop to something like that for like his own sick amusement to see the people's reaction when he does it.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a guy who left Calgary, couldn't go back to the U.S. because he never paid his taxes there and owed money and would have been thrown in jail. His wife gave him an ultimatum to leave Calgary, go back to England, never even made an effort to try to see his children. They came to him, but he never made an effort to go see them.
All right.
And again, the liberties he took with guys in the ring for no reason. Just a very bitter, angry guy who probably did have a little bit of little man complex, Napoleon complex, whatever you want to call it, did destroy his body, not only by what he put into it, but what he put it through.
Mm-hmm.
You watch those clips of him taking bumps, and he's taking bumps like nobody else is at the time. On a frame that is overly muscled and should not have that much weight on it. And Danny Spivey, who's one of the more interesting guys that they talked to during this thing, he talks about how Dynamite had muscular striations on his ass because he was just literally a block of muscle for how much gas he was doing at the time. And walking around with needles in his butt, and then they're just using him as darts on the wall. And, you know, putting a shotgun to his wife's head. Telling her one day it's going to be loaded. He's a very, very, maybe, I don't know, maybe more, not more than anybody, maybe, but the dichotomy of he is a phenomenal in-ring performer, maybe the best of his generation, to what a low-life human being he is. There may not be a bigger dichotomy other than, you know, the guy who idolized him and tried to pattern himself after him and kind of went above and beyond on that.
Yeah, we all know how that ended.
But I will say this. I think the most – you have a picture on screen right now of Scott McGee, who is Gary Ports, the son of Jeff Ports, a great international wrestler. Scott McGee might have been the most interesting contributor in this episode other than Dynamite's wife and Brett's wife.
I have two observations about this. One, I wish they had swapped out something else for Dynamite Kid, because an entire documentary based from the wife's perspective, so close to the one they just did with the Warrior, which was kind of the same thing – between Brian Pillman's wife, Warrior's ex-wife, and Dinah, my kid's wife or ex-wife, I was like, can we not do these like in a row? You know, the same style. Like, I know they were broken up by other episodes, but I feel like so close to the Warrior and Pillman that it was a lot of the same thing. It was, here's the story about a man who went crazy and died. Here's his wife.
I think the way they plotted them out, mm-hmm. it almost went in stages,
mm-hmm.
where Pillman was kind of a very loving dad, obviously, to his kids, mm-hmm. sort of a loving husband at certain points, really. And he did love, I don't doubt for a minute that he let himself believe he loved Melanie to mm-hmm. the end of the earth. That's why he left the other one to be with her and raise a family with her and whatever. And wasn't abusive towards her. He was abusive towards himself.
Yeah, sure.
Then you get Warrior, who kind of, as his star rises, things are not the same between him and his wife. And he doesn't necessarily become abusive, but he becomes emotionally distant.
Right.
And not as loving. And then they split. And then you have Dynamite, who, where things are taking a downward turn for him physically, even though he's doing well financially, he becomes abusive and horrible and just the worst.
This half of the season lacked a Herb Abrams episode.
I think every season lacks a Herb Abrams episode.
We're laughing at it, but I mean, like, that's such a funny story. You know, it's like the dark side of wrestling. That story is fucking hilarious.
Yeah, I don't get tired of hearing about Herb covered in petroleum jelly and cowboy boots chasing workers.
So I just like, I look, the nature of the series is we're going to hear a lot about drug, you know, substance abuse and horror stories and guys going off the deep end and dying and leaving crying relatives in their wake to tell their tale. I get that. But can't we, if you're going to break up your season, like, can't we find one episode to kind of throw in there and be like, and this is our clown episode. This one is, it's kind of dark, but you know, it's a guy walking around, in, you know, in petroleum jelly and cowboy boots.
Yeah, like maybe they could have fit one of the season two episodes that they were looking at, you know, maybe a little bit mm-hmm. earlier in, like maybe like the plane ride from hell. You know, that's a funny one.
The mid-season finale should have been the plane ride from hell for sure. Because I know what that's going to be another one like Collision and Korea I've read the articles where they focused on that and they were like, oh my God, the things we found out about. Okay. I'm not taking anything away. Nobody should have touched the stewardesses. I'm not saying that that's a thing that should have been allowed. I'm just saying the plane ride from hell is probably not as bad as they're making it out to be.
No, yeah. There's funny stuff. I've heard, the only negative of that is I don't know that we're going to hear anything that maybe if you followed this story kind of deeply mm-hmm. that you haven't heard before.
Yeah, I read an entire article about it. You know, there's fights on the plane. The worst thing that happens is Ric Flair pulling his dick out and trying to molest actually molesting the stewardesses.
Is that worse than singing love songs over the PA to your ex-wife?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, Baron Von Awesome.
I don't know. Flair's been doing that since, you know, he could get on planes. And I'm going
to go ahead and just once again remind you in our audience that no means no. my other comment about the Dynamite Kid, a lot of stuff I didn't know before. I didn't really follow the man's career outside of when he left after he left the WWF, and he was part of the British Bulldogs. So, you know, I learned a lot. It was an interesting episode. Another one where at the end of it, we're like, this is a real downer. Because some of these kind of end redemptively, you know, like they pull up. Not all of them, though. One. Yeah, not this one. This one is a steady.
They don't reference it in the episode, but obviously mm-hmm. his career is forever tied to Tiger Mask because of their influences, junior heavyweights. They did a Skype kind of call a few years back that they broadcasted where it was going to be Sayama, Tiger Mask, talking to Dynamite Kid. And you see, like, they get on the call, and Sayama's so animated. He goes, Tommy, my friend. And, you know, he's so excited and everything. And Dynamite's just in his wheelchair, barely able to move. Sammy. And it's like, oof, boy, this isn't good. And then I think he died about 3-4 months after that.
I already mentioned this with the Warrior, but this is an example of what I'm talking about. I think the guys who are like Bret Hart and Dynamite Kid and some of the other ones who take it too seriously, you know, and it becomes not even too seriously, because I think you can be a professional about your job and take it seriously, but still, this can't be all there is. Wrestling can't be everything. It can be a big thing. It can be obviously a big part of your life, a big part of your identity. But I think you have to make room for other things, and you have to know how to turn the page in your life and move on to something else when it's over. The guys that fail to do that are, you know, the tragic horror stories that we keep hearing about. And I think that's one of the elements of it. It was that they couldn't let this go or let anything else into their life.
I don't even know that that was the case with the Dynamite Kid, though, so much as just he's an angry little prick, and he was going to take it out on everybody the worse he felt. Like they don't even talk about a lot of the stuff. Like if you read Bret Hart's book, Davey Boy Smith came to Calgary after Dynamite. No, hang on,
I can't read Bret Hart's book. Gavin ruined it for me.
Neat. If you read Bret's book, basically he talks about how Dynamite came to Calgary first. He was recruited by Bruce Hart, and then they brought his cousin Davey over, and Davey lived with Dynamite, but Dynamite just tortured him and, like, for his own amusement, just made Davey's life miserable till finally Brett's like, hey, Davey, why don't you move in with me for a little while till you get yourself set up and whatever, just to basically rescue him from Dynamite, because it was noticeable that Dynamite constantly had him on edge and was, you know, just really doing a psych and emotional and physical job on him until Davey moved out and then finally kind of got aware of himself a little bit more once he started getting on the gas too. And was like, I'm bigger and stronger than you. This probably wouldn't end well for you. Okay. I feel all right. And, they don't go into Davey trademarking the name British Bulldog so that Dynamite can't use, you know, that later on, which basically stopped them from talking forever. And even though, like, Davey's kids had gone to visit Dynamite in England at one point, I know Harry did, I don't know if Georgia did, but Harry did. And spent time with him. It was just, I don't know that it was because he took the business so seriously. I think he just always in him had this innate mean streak from whatever it was, whether it was how he was trained in Wigan, in the snake pit where your bathroom was a bucket, whether it was, I don't know much about his home life. We didn't really talk much about, you know, his parentage or anything like that, or maybe he would, you know, had a bad home life, but he just was a miserable person who was not going to be happy unless everybody else around him was feeling some kind of misery. And he inflicted that on a lot of people through very cruel ribs like H-Bomb and Mitch Snow, or gluing Outback Jack's hat onto himself to the point where Outback Jack literally drew his buck knife and he was going to kill the Bulldogs for doing it. They would flick lit cigarettes into Jake's snake bag to piss off Damien to make the snake try to bite somebody. Just really, really awful stuff constantly. When Jacques Rougeau hits him with that roll of quarters, a lot of people saw it as his comeuppance and that it was long deserved for a while.
That's my favorite part of the episode, that whole story, just because I'd always heard about it like in passing, but I never got details on it. And yeah. Jacques Rougeau is the best part of that episode in terms of the most entertaining guy on there. He's hilarious.
I think the funny part was when they talked about giving Dino Bravo the stooge test.
That was so good.
Yeah. And so they give Dino Bravo the stooge test about how, you know, hey, Dino, you know this guy in Montreal, because they're all from Quebec. And Dino, Dino's from Quebec City. The Rougeaus are from Montreal, I believe. But they all know kind of the same figures who are involved in what. And Dino actually was involved with the mob, as people learned last season, if they didn't already know. And Jacques was like, yeah, see, this guy, I got to check in with him every day. And if I don't, something happens. Doesn't look good for Dynamite or his family. And Dino, of course, lets Dynamite know that that's going on. So they know Dino's a stooge. And that was just fantastic.
It really was.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, they don't talk about Dynamite constantly needling Ray, who had a knee injury at the time and couldn't really do anything. But Ray was a tough guy. Ray was a Province of Quebec Golden Gloves boxer. And so Ray could handle himself. He never was a braggadocious guy, but Ray could have handled himself. And that's probably why Dynamite went after Jacques instead of him, when he thought the Rougeaus ribbed him by cutting up his suit or whatever it was. That it was actually Mr. Perfect who did and led the Bulldogs to leave. Oh, I think it was those damn Rougeaus. And started the whole thing. But, you know, when Dynamite got his teeth knocked out and was forced to apologize and not be able to retaliate, a lot of people saw that as the end of him being the little pit bull that he was. And it was. He was never the same guy after that. He never even paid to have his teeth fixed, even though Vince gave him the money. And he just lived this miserable existence where once he was gone from the WWE, he was drinking every day and threatening his family and threatening to kill his wife. And so the wife, who is the sister of Bret Hart's ex-wife, Julie, would literally bring herself and the kids over to either Bret's or a motel to just try to be safe. And Bret talks about an instance where they had done the shotgun thing where Dynamite had the shotgun to his wife's head and said, one day it's going to be loaded, bitch. Mm. And at that point, get out, do whatever. And Bret's daughter, his oldest daughter, Beans, and Dynamite's daughter, Bronwyn, come running into his house. And they're like, oh, my God, it's my dad. It's my dad. He's on the block. And Bret has to go out and talk to him. Be like, Tommy, what the hell are you doing? You're threatening my wife and my kids now? Like, where are we going with this? Right. And he talks about he pissed all his money away and he doesn't know what he's doing, whatever. And that's when Michelle basically gives him the ticket and says, you need to go. Go back to England. You are not welcome here anymore. Just leave me and my children alone. And you see the pictures of him later when he does that one-off in Michinoku Pro as like a send-off match. He's just a frail human being whose tights don't fit him and he's sagging. And you want to feel bad for him, like especially if you're the kid who grew up watching and loving the Dynamite Kid. But when you know all these things about him, you don't, and you're kind of like, I won't say he deserved it because I don't think anybody necessarily deserves something like that, but you don't have any sympathy for him.
So I would say first half of season three, part one, pretty good. Just kind of looking over the list again. Brian Pillman was great. Nick Gage, you didn't watch, and it was meh. Collision Korea, meh.
It was meh? Yeah, that makes sense.
Warrior, I thought was good. Grizzly Smith was done well, just horrifying. And then the Dynamite Kid one I thought was done pretty well. Just a depressing subject matter. So, you know, final thoughts on part one of season three. I'm excited for part two. I know that's going to be the one that's personal to me with XPW, but there's a bunch more in here. I don't know who Ion Crutaro is.
That's the one I'm looking forward to most. That is Bruiser Bedlam / John K-9. Okay. Yeah, I'm so excited for that episode because, again, not many people are aware of this story, but when you hear it, you're going to be like, what the hell is this? How did this even happen? It's gonna be a lot of fun.
So see, that one they should have swapped out with Dynamite Kid.
No.
Because that's your Herb Abrams one.
No, it's not the Herb Abrams one. This is very dark. It's just an incredible story. Yeah.
The steroid trial. I mean, I what else are they going to say about the steroid trial that hasn't already been said? Bruce Pritchard, before he became, before his podcast became a bag of shit, went into all this already. And granted, Bruce Pritchard, the Artful Dodger, is
well, they talked to, supposedly they talked to Jerry McDivitt, who was Vince's lawyer for years and years. We'll see what he's able to say based on agreements of whatever the trial led, but. This is going to be an episode that depends very heavily on who they talk to and about what.
I've only heard the legends of FMW, so I'm really excited to see that one. I'm really excited to watch that one also with my wife, who hates blood and death matches. So that'll be fun. The plan.
Get ready for cherry bombs in the ass, Melissa. Not kidding.
Can't wait. But we've already talked about the plane ride from hell. I don't know anything about Luna Vachon's story. That seems fun. I'm sure it'll be educational.
I think that'll be a lot of fun. I think Luna, and I'm sure they'll touch on the whole Vachon family, which would be awesome because Mad Dog is maybe the best character ever. And, her Aunt Vivian, who was really a trailblazer in women's wrestling. I look forward to that, and I'm sure they'll talk to Gangrel, who was married to her for a long time. But Luna, awesome character, awesome performer, huge fan.
I'm sure they'll get into the Sable story.
Yeah.
They have to, right?
They will.
Then the one that's personal to me, XPW, I won't get into it now, but yeah, I worked for the company from pretty much almost its inception, just after its inception until right before Heatwave. So I might be on that episode in footage that I did not give permission to use. I'm on two episodes of XPW television. So we'll see. But I'm really looking forward to that. I'm also curious to see how much of Rob Black's post XPW story they're going to tell, like with the John Ashcroft porn trial and all that, and the year he did in prison. So I'm excited for that one. That's probably the one I'm most excited for, but that's only because it's personal. And then Chris Canyon's going to be depressing. How is Chris Canyon personal to you?
So when I was younger, one of my good friends, his mom worked in the same office as Chris Kanyon's brother. Okay. And one year, it was around Christmas time. It was like Christmas of like 1998. He came in with a bunch of like autographed pictures of not only Chris as Kanyon, but as Mortis too. And gave them to me, gave them to all our friends and stuff. And later on, when Chris had been released from WWE and was doing a lot of independent stuff, he was good friends with one of my cousin's coworkers and would give us tickets to shows, always say hi, how's everybody doing? Super mm-hmm. nice guy, was very cool. So that's going to be a hard watch for me, knowing, you know, what happens to Chris. But I think it's good his story gets told, because quite frankly, he's one of the nicest human beings that probably was ever in the wrestling business and deserved better than what he got.
Sure.
And I just like that Chris is finally getting some recognition. And, you know, it's one of those things where he was living as a gay man in a world that, you know, isn't necessarily always fair to the gay man. And that's – you have gay man power brokers who, you know, like Pat Patterson, who kind of don't – I don't know if it's because Pat's from a different era or whatever, but he just really didn't understand the struggle that Chris was going through at the time with his sexuality and that, you know, what it was. And Chris's story is one that deserves to be told. So we're okay. getting it.
All right, Pat, we're just about done. Your final words on this season.
Decent start. I think they could have done more with the material they had.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, I think the Grizzly Smith episode is probably one of the two or three best episodes of the show they've done as a whole.
All right. We'll be back. It comes back in September, so you figure it'll be done by October, beginning of November. We'll come back again to finish this up. What are you listening to these days? I know you keep giving me shit about the not bringing you on for the Motley Crue show. And then I keep pitching you albums that are coming out, or I tell you, like, bring me a wish list, and you're like, I'm drinking. I don't have time.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
So what kind of music are you listening to these days?
What was I playing? So this jukebox at the bar I got molested at had like a bunch of leftover credits in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I played everything from some Misfits to some Billy Squire.
Okay.
Because I always play Billy Squire after I've had a couple.
Of hand jobs or beers?
Either or.
Okay.
Six of one, half dozen of the other. Sure. Yeah.
Two out of three ain't bad.
Yeah. Did play some Meatloaf. but I played Dead Ringer for Love. That's a favorite. What else?
Well, this is why I bring that up, because if you click the link in the description of this podcast, you can get a free 30 days of AmazonMusic.com. One of our great sponsors here at W2M and the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network. The link is getAmazonMusic.com/W2M Network. You get a free 30 days of Amazon Music. You can listen to Meatloaf, because two out of three ain't bad. You could be a bat out of hell. Let me sleep on it. Anyway, you can listen to Meatloaf, Billy Squire. You can listen to any of the bands, Motley Crue. You can listen to any of the bands that we've been talking about, any of the bands that we've been reviewing on the Metal Hammer of Doom, like Bongzilla and Dr. Colossus. There's a Duran Duran album coming out later this year. You can go back and listen to the history of Duran Duran. We're reviewing Fear Factory next week. You can listen to old Fear Factory on AmazonMusic.com. So click the link, sign up for the service, get a free 30 days to stream to try it out. You don't like it, you cut it off. No fuss, no muss. You love it like we do. You keep using it. You keep paying the service fee. You listen to music makes your life better, Pat. It just makes your life better.
If you have an Echo Dot, why don't you have this service? It's really great. You're just bored. Say, hey, whatever you call your Echo Dot, whether it be Alexa, whether it be Echo, whatever. Say, I want to hear Oh Girl by the Shy Lights. It'll do it.
Yes, sir. All right. That's it. That's the end of our show. As far as we've been doing these video podcasts now, we started with an on trial for Back to the Future 2. That was me and Jesse. We did a review for In the Heights earlier today. Lily was on that. Lily was on that as well.
How dare you view that movie, which is with its underrepresentation of darker skinned Latinos.
We talked about that too. Yesterday was a very busy day. Not only did we do the Back to the Future 2 podcast video cast, but we also did just a strictly audio review of NXT TakeOver In Your House and Against All Odds. That's on the same episode. That's me and Harry Broadhurst.
The Phil Collins song?
That's me and Harry Broadhurst. Jesse dropped an Unspoken Issues number 33, Secret Defenders number 1. So you can check that out. That's strictly audio. We did another re-air. Apparently, people are now the babies on Twitter are demanding a Schumacher cut of Batman Forever. So that was
everyone
trending.
Demanding that gets AIDS.
Anyway, so that was trending on Twitter for a little bit. So to kind of take advantage of the Twitter trend,
Schumacher sucks. His movie sucked. You really want to see a longer, crappier version of a bad movie? Is this what we're doing now? Because we did that with the Snyder version, which sucked.
Yes, that's what we're doing. That's where
we
come to.
He's a hack too.
So we did a re-airing of our Long Road to Ruin for Batman, the Schumacher
Sly,
years.
Save us with the extended cut of Rocky IV, please. I'm begging you.
We re-aired our Long Road to Ruin for Back to the Future, which pissed off Jesse in the first place, and that's why we did the on-trial that we did. And we kicked off the week with a Metal Hammer of Doom review of Green Jelly's Garbage Band Kids. Next week, we've got a comic book review for Sweet Tooth Volume 1. We'll have a review of Luca. My kids will be on that one, too. Pat, you'll be back next week. Tuesday night, we've got The Four Kings of Boxing, Chapter 2, Marvin Hagler.
Yes, and thanks to Grammarly, my notes were legible for you.
Hot damn. We'll also have a review of Hell in the Cell. So, I mean, theoretically, except for the Metal Hammer of Doom, these will all be video, unless we say otherwise. Speaking of which, we'll have that review of Fear Factory for you in audio only. And then Ronnie Adams will be back on the network, and we'll be reviewing season 1 of Sweet Tooth.
Hey, Ronnie.
We also have a Pantera retrospective that's re-airing, and our Damn You Hollywood review of Inside Out that's re-airing as well. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention it. And if I don't mention it, Jason Teasley will be awfully sore at me. We will be doing a Long Road to Ruin for Porky's. That's going to air late Friday night, early Saturday morning. Yes, Porky's. Porky's.
I'll never forget that tallywhacker. It had a mole on it.
That's right. That was fun. Those were fun times. We binged those over the weekend. All right, Pat, other than what I've plugged for you, anything you're working on?
No, Mark, I only do these things with you. We've got our Four Kings podcast coming on. We're very shortly going to have WrestleMania 3 retrospective on our road through the mania of WrestleMania. Our next episode, along with Chris Bailey, is going to be taking a look at the one many consider the one that broke everything open, WrestleMania 3 from the Pontiac Silverdome in Pontiac, Michigan in 1987.
We're threatening to do that on July 15th.
July 15th.
July 15th.
Day after Mom's birthday and my best friend's birthday. Go figure.
The greater
and Jeff good. Jarrett. That's J-E-double-F. Ha-ha.
And we have a date. We'll see if we make that date for an Unsolved Mysteries, Ric Flair's WWF title run. Yep, we threatened to do it many years ago. We're actually going to finally do it. All right, Pat, this has been a lot of fun. Nice seeing you on camera.
Always nice to see you, sir.
All right. Folks, for Pat Mullen, I'm Mark Rattledge. Be well, be safe, and behave.